the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. Hi, this is John Barber live in Las Vegas. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny," the night he hosted The Tonight Show. In his introduction, Frank mentioned I was a film critic. As most of you know, I was the second person in America to review movies on television, Judith Kriss being the first on The Today Show, but I was the first to do it in the evening news. 10 years with Los Angeles Magazine and 5 years with KNBC. I'm going to talk very briefly about critics because we are all critics. And I will also function as one when I introduce shortly my fabulously interesting guest with a film and stories you will love. I'm prompted to do this because of the absolutely amazing, articulate, insightful reviews many of you have posted on Amazon as a result of seeing our film, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. We have purposely made this must-see movie available to you for only $1.99 so everyone can afford to see it. Personally, I have always loved witty film critics, from Dorothy Parker, who years ago described one actress as running the full gamut of emotions from A to B, and James Agee of Time magazine, who went on to write African Queen, one of Bogart's and Hepburn's best films. One of my close friends in Los Angeles was Bert Prelutsky, who went on to write for MASH. Bert wrote for the Los Angeles Times, and he had one of my favorite lines about a movie, and the movie was called Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And his review stated simply, "It starts out with a bang and ends up chitty." But the very best line ever was by Gary Deeb, who used to write for the Chicago Tribune. Gary said, "Television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product." It's just the best line I've ever heard about television. And speaking of Time magazine, I was quoted there a few times. I was Tom Snyder's sidekick on the 6 o'clock news on NBC in Los Angeles for 5 years. And Tom, I am certain, was the inspiration for Ted Knight's fabulous character, the anchor man in Mary Tyler Moore's show. Anyway, Tom was about to leave NBC locally to do The Tomorrow Show on the network on NBC late night. And he wanted me, he said, to be a guest frequently on his show to talk about movies. Anyway, when he was doing his last telecast, the NBC brass asked me if I would do a review of him as he sat next to me before he left. And I said, "Tom Snyder is the kind of anchorman who gives you the impression the news is there to bring you him." I never did get one appearance on Tom's Tomorrow Show. Anyway, as a critic, I've seen thousands of films and many more thousands of YouTube videos, just like the rest of you. 2 weeks ago, I saw not only an enormously interesting, compelling film, but one that was cinematically, perfectly, technically produced from audio to visuals by my guest and his son. It's called 911 Missing, about the literally thousands of unexplained disappearances of all kinds of people, from cripples to kids, who vanish while visiting our national parks. I first heard of my guest when my friend George Knapp did a terrific story about him for CBS. He has a 20-year background in law enforcement, making him the perfect person to be investigating these disappearances. He is also an expert on the legend of Bigfoot, but it's his very popular 6 books about 911 missing that resulted in his being interviewed all over the world over 800 times. Now it's my turn. A delight to welcome a terrific storyteller, terrific writer, and now a terrific filmmaker, David Paludis. David, welcome so much to the show. I really appreciate your being here.
Hey, John, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, I must tell you, I have always wondered, the people that I like and admire, I'm always curious as to how they became the people I like and admire. So very briefly, could you tell me a little bit about your current family, a little bit about the family into which you were born, what they were like when you were a youngster, what it was you were interested in doing as a kid, and how did you end up getting into law enforcement?
Well, all good questions, John. I grew up in the Bay Area. I was born in San Francisco. My dad was a fireman for 32 years, and we lived just south of San Francisco in a small community called Cupertino, and I spent my whole life there, kind of an upper middle class neighborhood. I had just a sister that was 3 years younger than me. We had a pretty idyllic childhood. But for some reason, and I could never explain it, but I always wanted to be a policeman. And I suppose I had the ways and means to do a lot of different things. But in the back of my mind, I always wanted to be a cop. And I graduated from high school, and I had really good grades and good test scores. I went into Berkeley. I spent 2 years at Cal. And school and I didn't get along. That school and I didn't get along at all. And without telling my parents, I went out and I took the test for a small town called Fremont Police. I always wanted to go to San Jose, but San Jose was only hiring bilinguals under a consent decree program, so I couldn't get in. Yeah. And I went to Fremont, worked there for 3 years, 3.5 years. And then laterally transferred to San Jose when they dropped the consent decree. Spent a total of 20 years in law enforcement, worked all major assignments. I was a very lucky guy because commanders kept taking me for pristine positions. I worked different task forces, vice intelligence, street crimes unit, etc. And I left the police department. By that time, I had already gone back to school and had a master's degree. And I liked working with people, and I got a degree in human resources. And I had a good friend of mine that was the head of human resources for Fujitsu North America. And he said, hey, come work for me. And I could really use the common sense approach that you have to life. And I ended up working in human resources for about 5-6 years, retired again. And I was doing some research in a national park. And at about this time, I had a son and a daughter, a son, Ben, who went on to play Division I hockey at Miami, Ohio.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Right now he's in grad school at USC Film School. I have a daughter named Nicole, and Nicole went on to be a Division I rower at Indiana University, and she is working for a startup up in San Francisco. So both kids are doing really well.
Good for you and good for them.
Yeah.
And your son was involved in your film.
He co-directed the movie with – he co-directed Missing 411, the movie, with Mike DeGrazia. And those two guys, phenomenal talents.
Well, it's more than phenomenal because I must tell you, as I said in the introduction, having seen thousands of films – I was initially overwhelmed by the technical excellence of your movie. I mean, aside from the fact that stories were unbelievable, but I want to do a little rewind for a minute. You said that, you know, on your own, you went to Fremont to become a cop. Well, once you became a cop, what did your parents say when you went home and they saw you in uniform?
Well, my mom was always a really passionate, polite, comforting kind of mom. And well, I think whatever I wanted to do, as long as it was ethical and moral, she would have supported me. My dad, I think the first words out of his mouth is, "You're an idiot." And well, you know, you don't want to work for government and on and on and on. And I, you know, at my age, I was 20 years old at the time, and I had the support of my mom. That's what I really cared about. And I knew I was doing something right. And it was something I really wanted to do. And I couldn't get it out of my system. So I was just following my
dream. You said that you like to work with people. For 15 years, I played in the police celebrity golf tournament in Los Angeles. So I had a lot of close friends who were policemen. And when Tom Bradley ran for mayor opposite Tom Yorty, I was a fellow that wrote the jokes that helped get him elected. And one that he particularly loved, Yorty had accused him. You know, Yorty would never say out loud that Tom was black, or he would never refer to him as Uncle Tom Bradley. But he always implied that if Bradley got into office, there'd be crime in the streets. And so we had Tom Bradley at a large press conference when he was confronted by that question by somebody who was supporting Yorty. Bradley said, "Yes, Tom will have to have some place to conduct his business." Well, he got elected. But the stories that I heard from these dedicated police officers, some of them were horrifying. I would like to hear from you. One of the things, since you said you liked people, you were going to see people at the worst if you're in the police department. One of the worst things you ever saw as a policeman, and then one of the best things you ever saw as a policeman.
Well, I think one of the worst is seeing a father accused by a suspect of abusive things. And I'm talking specifically about the Polly Klass case. And Polly was a girl that was kidnapped in Petaluma.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yes.
Well, the FBI agent in charge of that case knew a sergeant in San Jose and said, "Hey, I need you to bring your best guy with you and help us up here, you know, under mutual aid, because we're still looking for the suspect." The sergeant picked me and we went up there and worked that case. And I just remember that when Richard Allen Davis was arrested, that he accused Polly's dad of some horrendous things. And I knew Mr. Klass. I'd gone to lunch with him. And he's just a stand-up, great guy. And to see the horror on his face when he was accused of these hideous things by someone who shouldn't, in my view, even be alive.
Oh, yeah.
It was horrific.
Oh, my. And then one of the best things you ever saw as a policeman, something that might have surprised you.
There were a few things. I mean, there were many times where I solved crimes that were seemingly unsolvable, and I was able to get things back to victims. And I think the surprise on their face, because in our world, you know, you don't expect to get anything back. So when you do, it's kind of a big surprise. And for that,
now you're into the business of looking at, when I look at this wonderful film of yours, 411 Missing, you were solving crimes then, and now you've gotten into a position where these unbelievable cases pop up and they look absolutely unsolvable. So what prompted you, first of all, to do your very first story about somebody who was missing that you felt was just something strange?
Well, you know, when you read 100 missing person reports, nothing really will seem unusual. They will all seem, you know, the person disappeared, there was a search, nothing was found, blah, blah, blah. When you read 5,000 or 6,000 cases, as I have, there's certain things that start to fall out, and there's a certain commonality, profile points, we call them. And in many of these cases, about 1,600 of them that I've written about to this point in 6 books, there are these certain profile points that are in each of these cases that we pull aside and we'll look at. And the predominant profile point is they bring canines to the scene and the dogs can't find a scent. Or the dogs don't want to work. They'll walk around in a circle and maybe lay down. They'll walk up the trail, come back to the handler. or they'll search an area and they can't find the scent, which is seemingly impossible because in a vast majority of these cases, there's multiple witnesses saying the victim was right here 1 second and gone the next. At the beginning, the first five books I wrote about, all of these were disappearances in national parks and national forests and rural spaces of North America and nine other countries that match these profile points.
But one of these stories caught your eye and made you write your first one. Do you recall what it was?
Absolutely. It was so I lived in Cupertino at the time, and there, right, the city right next door to us is this real nice city called Saratoga. Well, back in 1981, there was a 14-year-old girl named Stacy Aris, and she lived in a great little house, mom and dad, other sisters. Well, in July of 81, her and her dad decide that they're going to take a horseback trip in Yosemite with an organized group of eight other people, and they're going to go into a place called Upper Cathedral Lake and Sunrise High Sierra Camp. Well, the group was led by a wrangler that had a permit to go into the park, and he did this all the time. And he led the group into the Sunrise High Sierra Camp. They all dismounted. He took the horses. Stacy went into her cabin with her dad, changed, brought her camera out, and said, "Hey, Dad, I'm going to walk down the way with one of the older men. We're going to sit on this point, and I'm going to take pictures." Dad says, "Great." Well, they're at 9,200 feet. Everybody can see her and this older man sitting on this rock. And then she gets up and she walks downhill towards the lake and disappears into this area near the lake that's filled with trees. And she told the man that she'd be back in just a little bit. Well, the man just waits and waits and waits. Finally, some other people come over to him and says, "Oh, when's she supposed to be back? Blah, blah, blah." Well, she never came back. And that started an enormous search. That was rounded up by Yosemite National Park. And at the time, they dedicated 57 helicopter hours, 8,000 man hours, and they budgeted $100,000 in an almost a three-week search to find Stacy. Now, they never found her. The only thing they located was right at the entry point where she walked into this tree line around the lake. They found her lens cap cover. That was it. And it's hard to imagine her getting lost at this lake because she walked downhill from this giant granite field into this lake. And wherever you were at that lake, you could turn and see that boulder granite field. Well, when I heard about this and I first started rolling on these disappearances, I knew that the National Park Service had the largest contingent of federally trained law enforcement officers in the U.S., National Park Police. So I filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests against the National Park Service for her file. And at the time, it was 33 years old.
Wow.
Well, I got a call back about a month after I filed it from a special investigator from the Park Service named Agent Yu, Y-U. And he asked me why I wanted the file. And I told him, "Well, according to the Freedom of Information Act, you can't ask me that question. Because the Freedom of Information Act has specific guidelines, and one of them is the government can't ask you why you want something." And he says, "I just want to know." I said, "Well, I'm just doing research." And he says, "Well, you're never going to see this file." I thought, wow, I talk to law enforcement people all the time. I've never had one talk to me like that. And he said, "Yeah, you'll never see it." And I said, "Well, is it classified as a missing person case?" "Yes." And I said, "Well, are there any suspects?" "No." "Is there suspicion of a crime?" "No." I said, "Has anybody even looked at the case in the last 15 years? He said, "I doubt it." And I said, "Then why won't you give it to me?" He goes, "Because we don't do that." And I said, "Well, I had filed against the Park Service on six other cases on missing people. And I have those cases. Why aren't I getting this?" And he called me a liar, saying, "No, you don't have those cases." And in reality, I do, and I've had many others since. But for some reason, this case is one that the Park Service won't give up for some reason, and the facts surrounding it are odd at best, and it's disturbing.
To you, what was the most bizarre case that you ever came across? Because one that was in the film was one where somebody disappeared, but they found the clothing.
You know, that is not uncommon. I've written about cases in the past where clothing is found within 100, 200 yards of where they were last seen, and there wasn't enough time for hypothermia or heat to set into the body. So why the clothes came off and why the shoes came off in many of the cases doesn't make any sense. But probably the most disturbing case is one that happened in 69 at Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and a young boy, 6 years old, named Dennis Martin. And he was vacationing up in a location called Spence Field with his dad, his grandpa, and his brother. And it was over Father's Day weekend. And they had hiked in about 4 or 5 miles to this large field. And the kids were kind of running around. And a series of odd things happened. And I know because I got this file, and it's about 3 inches thick from the Park Service. The first thing that happens is that they're in this field by themselves, and this family walks out of nowhere up to them. And they said, "Hey, can our kids play with your kids?" Mr. Martin says, "Sure." And she goes, "Oh, my name is so-and-so." Well, that family's name was Martin as well. And you think about the odds in the middle of nowhere running into another family with the last name Martin. Pretty weird. But the kids are playing hide-and-seek. Mr. Martin says that he's sitting there in his chair watching exactly where his kids are going. And he sees Dennis run behind a tree right on the edge of the field. And a couple minutes go by, the kids are playing, and everyone says, "Okay, come on out." Well, Dennis doesn't come out. So Mr. Martin walks over to the tree, and Dennis isn't there. Well, the tree was adjacent to the Appalachian Trail that runs through the park. And Mr. Martin runs down that trail because he was a runner, runs it for 2 miles, thinking his son must have walked down the trail, and his son didn't. That started a 3-week search, probably the most massive search I've ever seen for anyone in any national park. And the story that's hard to believe, but it's factual, is the Green Berets landed in helicopters in that park. And they had a contingent there that was huge that searched. Well, the National Park Service offered the Green Berets to search with the National Park Service rangers, since the rangers knew the park. And the Green Berets said, "No, we have our own way to search. We'll search alone." They set up their own communication center, their own camp, and they were kind of isolated from everybody else. Now, at the day that Dennis disappeared, there was a family. And the last name of this family was called the Key family. And this is a key point. The Key family was about 3 miles away, downhill from where Dennis disappeared, and they were walking up this valley. And one of the sons says, "Hey, Dad, look up there. I see something running between the trees." And the dad goes, "Yeah, I see that too. It looks like a man, kind of." And they hear this rattling scream that they said was very loud. They thought it was louder at the time than a child. And this man or whatever they see runs behind a tree and disappears. Well, the Key family doesn't think anything of it and just thinks, "Oh, that's kind of weird." And they go home to their house that's also in Tennessee. And a couple days later, they see the front page of the Knoxville Times, and there's a picture of Dennis Martin saying that he's missing and blah, blah, blah. And so the family thinks, "Well, maybe we ought to call the FBI agents that are on this case in Tennessee and tell them about what we heard." So they call the park. The park says, "Yeah, just stay where you're at. We'll send somebody to meet with you." That's odd, because law enforcement always wants you to come to the scene and show us what you saw. Where were you? What was the location? What was your visibility like? But no, an FBI agent and a park representative go and meet the Key family. Mr. Martin had an agreement with the FBI and with the Park Service that if they had any information about their son, they'd tell him. Well, the Park Service never said anything about this. And a reporter came to him later on and says, "Hey, did you know about this observation made by the Key family?" And he said, "No." And that caused a huge rift. And he thought that they were hiding information. And the agent told him that it was just a family that saw a man running between trees that was just having a good time, blah, 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 and didn't make anything about it. Well, the Key family later on said that wasn't true, and that what they saw was a man wearing like pelts and furs run between trees, somebody who lived in the forest or something, and they don't know why he yelled. Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, I went to Knoxville, and the house that the Martin family lived in at the time Dennis disappeared, they still lived in that same house. And myself and another investigator knocked on the door. Mr. Martin came to the door.
That's in the film.
No, it's not in the film.
This is there's a similar thing in the film.
Where there is.
Okay, go ahead.
And Mr. Martin came to the door, and I explained who I was. And he said, you know, my wife made an – I had made an agreement about 5 years ago that we wouldn't talk about the case anymore because it's really taken our lives. And, you know, and he said, I hope you respect me. And I explained, hey, I came from California. I probably know more about the case than anybody. You know, could you come and talk to me? And he says, yeah, I will. And he came outside. He ended up talking to us. And he talked about this Key family observation. And he said, you know, it wasn't in any of the reports. And when you get the reports, you're not going to see anything about it. And he goes, to this day, I know that they were hiding information about this case. And I don't know why to this day. And I ask, when I interview people, I always ask them, is there something that I should know that isn't readily available to the public? And he says, yeah. And he says, you know the FBI agent on that case? And I said, yeah. And I named him. And I also told him that I knew that that agent was involved in investigating a series of disappearances across the Great Smoky Mountains of people in isolated rural areas.
And he said, why would the FBI be investigating when the Parks Department has the largest contingency of searchers available?
Well, the Park Service says that when an investigation gets too big, too complex for their agents to handle, they'll bring in the FBI for forensics. But this FBI agent told the press he wasn't there investigating. He was just there, quote unquote, monitoring. And Mr. Martin asked me, he goes, do you know what happened to that agent? I said, no, I never did find out. And he said, well, he committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Oh, my goodness. How many of these missing cases happen every year in America? And George Knapp, when his excellent story about you, he said after he'd spoken to you and heard that you could not get a lot of information from the government, he himself, with his credentials, could not get it either. Why would the government not release these stories to you people?
You're asking the million-dollar question, John. I wish I could give you the answer. And it appears as though at some level, it may be an issue of dollars and cents. And it almost seems like extortion, and I'll tell you why. Is that when I asked for a list of missing people from the National Park Service police, they said they don't have a list. And I went back to a series of investigative journalists I know, with George being the number one guy. And I said, hey, what do you make of that? And he goes, they're blatantly lying. He said, there's no police department in the U.S. that's as large as they are that doesn't have a list of missing people in their jurisdiction. It just doesn't happen. And at the time, I was a printed author, and I said, hey, I want to use my author status, and I want you to get the list for me and give it to me. Well, about a month and a half later, an attorney from the National Park Service calls me and says, well, we found out that your books aren't in enough libraries to qualify for that exemption.
Oh, my God. That's just horrifying. How many missing cases are there? I think you said there were either 20 or 40 just every year in Oregon. And if you multiply that by 50 states, that's a couple of thousand.
Oh, at least. But the problem is that the government won't tell us about them unless we get them off archive news links. Or at this point, I'm getting a pretty big name out there, so I get a lot of contacts from families and things saying, hey, would you look at this case? But one last note before I move on from the National Park Service. So when they said they didn't have a list to give me, I said, okay, what if I'm willing to pay for it? And they said, okay, well, a list from our entire system will cost you $1.4 million.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. In these cases, was there ever a time when a body might have been discovered a year later, or a couple of miles away? Anything like that?
You know, in In a book I wrote called Missing 411, The Devil's in the Detail, I have a series of tables in the back that outline the distances and the elevations that people are found in if they're found deceased or barely alive. And I outline a series of small children that disappeared, and they were, a couple of children were found more than 3,000 feet higher in elevation than where they disappeared. And when you interview the parents of these kids and you ask them, what would your two-year-old child do if they were lost in the woods? The majority of parents say, well, they'd run around in circles for a while, get tired, sit down and take a nap, or they'd find something nearby to play with, or they'd run downhill. Asking a parent if their child would climb 3,500 feet uphill, nobody believes it. And then you have other notes where it's distance traveled. You know, how far on level ground would a two-year-old travel in 12 hours? Well, we used Les Stroud in the movie to try to replicate a journey of one of these two-year-olds that traveled 9 miles in 12 hours over two mountain ranges. And halfway, we had a film crew with Les who was in the middle of the night trying to make it, and he stopped in the middle and said, there's no way I'm going to do this. I can't do this. He goes, there's no way a child would do this. And the reality was is that in darkness, you would walk in circles. You would never walk a straight line. True. So, you know, the 9 miles that this person traveled point to point, they had to have walked, he figured, you know, 15 to 20 miles. And he said, that's impossible.
Well, I can tell you for sure, when I was 12 years of age, I was sent to a reform farm up in northern Ontario and trying to take a shortcut from a lake to a farm. Myself and two other kids got lost, and we passed the same point three or four times. How does that happen? I could never understand that.
That's a good question. I thank goodness I've never been lost like that, but you know, children and young kids, you probably get busy with your conversation. You're not paying attention to the sun. You're not paying attention to landmarks you see in the horizon, et cetera.
Well, it's the most frightening thing that could happen to a child, and it happened to us, and they sent helicopters looking for us, and fortunately we survived. And in bear country. Now, the other thing is, I know as a police officer, you would not want to speculate unless you had all kinds of facts. But you are also famous for being probably one of the most authoritative people when it comes to the subject of Bigfoot. Can you imagine or speculate on what it is with some of these disappearances? I know one of the stories in the film talks about a young person who was, everybody said, even the police said, and the parks police said that, well, she was probably killed by a mountain lion. But her clothes had no blood on them. There was nothing to indicate that she'd been attacked by a mountain lion, and she was never found. So do you speculate on what you think it could be, or do you keep those speculations to yourself?
You know, John, the first thing I never do is I never mix the topic of missing people and Bigfoot. And the reason being is that there's people listening to this show that think Bigfoot is a big joke and that the people investigated are idiots. And I will attest to that a large percentage of the people involved in the Bigfoot world are questionable at best.
Now, the same is true of the JFK assassination investigation, too. So I know exactly what it is you're saying.
So I like to say I live in the world of facts, and there are no facts on these disappearances that point to any one specific cause other than it's the impossibility of those people making that journey. And one thing I tell when I'm at conferences and things and I'm talking is I always put the parents in the position of the search and rescue people. You know, if this was your five-year-old child, how far would they travel? What would they do? What's their mentality like, et cetera? And the truth is that these cases are so far outside the bounds of what search and rescue calls normal disappearances and standard disappearance locations that search and rescue normally can't find them in those grids that they set down. I like to say that, you know, I'm a mile wide and an inch thick when it comes to different types of investigations and causes and things. And I'm the first person that would point to a cause if there was one consistent issue. But the people who have I've written 6 books about this right now, and they're all titled Missing 411. And I can tell you that of the people that have read the books, they all applaud the fact that there's no supposition, there's no theory, there's just straight facts. I lay down what happened. I lay down the unusual nature of the distances, the elevations. I include graphs and tables in the back of the book to outline and support that this is unusual. And I'll quote search and rescue manuals about what they say is normal and what isn't.
Well, I must tell you, the books are not only astonishing, but the stories that you show in the film are just absolutely riveting. And it is just astonishing to me. And I keep thinking to myself, I wonder if in these thousands of cases that you've looked into, has there been one that's turned out with a happy ending?
Well, I think we outline one in the movie that involves a 2-year-old that disappears in Oregon, and he's missing, and there's a large search, and unbelievably, they find him, and he's alive, and he ends up living, and we ended up tracking this guy down years later, and it was a great interview. One of the consistent things, too, in all of these cases that we outline is that if the person is found alive, the strange part about it is they have no memory of what happened to them. It's very strange.
That is just astonishing. Well, I must tell you, David, you can tell your son that he did an absolutely magnificent job in helping put together your film, 411 Missing, your books. Where can people go to see the film? How much would it cost them if they downloaded the film? And where can they go to get your books?
Well, I would say don't go to Amazon or any other reseller to get our books. We don't sell there. We only sell on our website, which is Can-Am. That's like Canadian American, canammissing.com. Our books are $24.95. If you go to Amazon, you're going to pay like $70 or $80.
Wow. You're kidding.
No, there's resellers just ripping people off. Oh, we don't sell there.
Oh, my God. So repeat that again. They go to Can-Am?
CanAmMissing.com. Now, on the movie side of things, you can download it and rent it for $4.99 on Amazon, iTunes. I think it's on all the various players right now. I can tell you, a lot of people have said what you said, John. And then there's a lot of people out there that have been making comments that are completely untrue. So I don't even think they've watched the movie, which is a little horrifying. They just go out there and they think that we're dissing the National Park, the National Park Service. And in reality, I encourage people to go to National Parks and I support the National Park Service. But I just talk about the facts on missing people, where there's a group out there that really dislike the fact I'm saying anything negative about the National Park Service. And in turn, diss our movie because of that, unfortunately.
Well, again, I want to thank you so much for being here, David, and thank you so much for the books and the film. Once again, where can they get the books? And they go to Amazon and iTunes, because I know on iTunes that's near one of the most popular films that people search and view for $4.99. So repeat it again.
So it's Missing 411. That's the title of the movie. You can go to iTunes or Amazon, and either one, you can download the movie. If you want to buy a DVD or a Blu-ray, you can come to our site and buy the books. That's Can-Am, like Canadian American, canammissing.com.
Well, David, thank you very, very much for being here. I really, really appreciate it. And in return, I hope you get a chance. I think I sent you a link to the film that we just did. And I look forward to it. Did you get the link?
I did get the link, and I'm looking forward to watching it, John.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and I await your review. It'd be your turn to be the critic, but I must tell you, I am really, really impressed by the work that you guys do. Again, thank you so much for being here, and best of luck to you.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be on your show, John. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Thank you again. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli, my my cohort here and probably the author of the very best, most independent, most objective newsletter in America, News Vendor. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back. This is John Barber and John Barber's World. And for me, always one of the greatest parts of the show is getting to talk to Joe Satilli so you and I can be informed of what's happening in the real world out there, as if you can call Washington, D.C. the real world. Joe, it's just a delight to talk to you again. What is it that you would like to get off your chest right now? And do you have any comments about David's stories about these missing folks and why the federal government would not give him the stories and the information about their investigations and wouldn't even give it to George Knapp at CBS?
Well, isn't that the rub with everything? And it actually overlaps what we're experiencing with this long, soapy, operatic drama that plays out every day like a really bad serial from 1947. and what David was experiencing and George Knapp experienced trying to investigate these things Whenever you start to cover things up or you refuse to be transparent, particularly in an official capacity or when you are elected to an official capacity, it creates speculation and suspicion and it metastasizes. It always does.
Word. What a great word, metastasize. Good for you.
I mean, that's what rationale would there be for the U.S. Park Service to cover this stuff up? So once you get there, then all of a sudden that's where the speculation and the imagination has to come in. And I'm not saying imagination in a negative sense. I'm saying that that's what, you know, this is how, this is one of the things that made Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's iconic investigator, so good at investigating, because he had an active imagination. Some people believe because the character was addicted to cocaine, but but be that as it may, this is where, you know, conspiracies are often uncovered. And I didn't want to say conspiracy theory, because one of the things, you know, we just had a death, a guy who was the lead singer of Linkin Park and another guy who was a singer of Soundgarden recently, a guy named Chris Cornell, both committed suicide recently. And what is burning up, these are both, look, they're artists, they're singers. You know, you've talked to John Potash a number of times, and not all suicides are what they're cracked up to be when it comes to things in music and popular culture, particularly when it comes to the 60s and the 70s and activism and the intersection of activism and music. But there's no sense that Chris Cornell or the lead singer of Linkin Park were activists. Chester Bennington, I believe his name was. But what has happened in the last 48 hours is that the Pizzagate conspiracy theory has now been glommed on to these guys, and now the internet is burning up with this story about how these two guys were on the verge of uncovering the Pizzagate child pedophilia ring.
Oh my!
They were suicided. Well, there's not one stitch of evidence, none, zippo, zilch. And this is one of the problems that we face, is that honest brokers and people like this guy, David, that you just spent the first half of the show with, who said, what? I'm all about the facts. I'm not about speculation. Here are the facts. Here is everything that I can collect that my investigations will allow me to collect and that the government will give over to me before they finally say no. Then you have that point where you have to make the leap and you have to be imaginative. But there has to be some foundation in facts. And what I'm afraid of, John, and this is something because I want to ask you about how things are going with the movie. This is one of the things that's so different about the environment we're in now and the kinds of conspiracies, whether it was JFK or it was Watergate, Iran-Contra, the CIA crack cocaine pipeline that Gary Webb uncovered. These are things that had actual tangible chains of evidence that we could identify that made sense and started to fit into a rational story. Now we're in an environment where, because the president is willing to say anything he wants, you know, I do not underestimate the pernicious power of him saying that Ted Cruz's dad was there with Lee Harvey Oswald, and it was something that was traded out of the Inquirer. That is the kind of stinking miasma, a cloud that hangs over all of the good work that people are doing and taints all that good work with this specious horse hockey that's going off to the side. And so one of the things I really appreciate about what David was doing was, I'm just going to pin down all the facts I can and not get into speculation, although that's where the mind wants to go, because these are unanswered questions.
Could the reluctance of the government to turn over these files be as simple as the Jaws syndrome? In the movie Jaws, he didn't want the word to get around that there was a shark in the water, because people wouldn't come to the beach and spend their money. Do you think it could be that simple? And if it's that simple, why on earth would, as he said, the investigators and the FBI make a trip to the people who were witnesses rather than having the witnesses make statements and come to their offices. Do you think it's that simple?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that is a plausible explanation. Then again, I've been to Glacier National Park within 10 days of a grizzly bear killing somebody.
Oh, my.
They still let you into the park. Now, that, I mean, you would think that would dissuade. There's your Jaws theory in action.
Yes.
They just said, right. You know, wear a bell or clap every 3 minutes when you're walking and hiking. I actually, my second wife and I at the time, we actually encountered a grizzly bear and her mother in a glade. And instead of doing what we're supposed to do, which is stand still, we ran our asses off but, and clapping and screaming. But it seems, you know, this actually gets to, I hate to do these things, but I'm going to go there. I've a lot of people have come at me with UFO stuff. And I actually tried to get a documentary made a long time ago called The Search for Cosmic Jesus about people who worship aliens as religious figures, because I find these things very interesting. And I went to Roswell. I went there for the UFO festival that happens on the 4th of July. I talked to a lot of people. A lot of people really, really believe. But, you know, there is an idea out there that makes a lot of sense, that the UFO story has been an effective way to cover up military technology reveals.
True.
And military operations, right? You create a little story, it's a red herring, people follow it, and then you can fly all your stuff from the technology you captured from the Nazis, and you can test it out, and then nobody knows what you're doing, and you're able to do it freely. One wonders, particularly with the arrival of the Marines, and the secrecy, if there's something else there. I would almost go with the close encounters of a third kind. If we're going to do Spielberg theories for explaining this, I'll go with the close encounters of the third kind, where to cover up an operation, what they did is they pretended like there was a massive anthrax outbreak and quarantined an area. So you do wonder if there's some other military technology that's being protected or some other military operation. But then again, we're now back into pure speculation. Who knows? This could be spontaneous human combustion. You might remember.
I remember those.
Remember that? A competitor to yours. That's incredible. A show that was made to compete with real people. Probably one of the only times they came close to real people was when they ran a shocking story about spontaneous human combustion.
I remember it well because I used it when I sued them.
Did you?
Yes, I sued and they settled out of court, which kept my son in Stanford for a few years. But you know what you're just talking about going out to Roswell. And you know what? You should think, Joe, about making a movie, a sort of an English version, maybe John Cleese and his crew come to America in search of UFOs, and they've seen Steven Spielberg's movie, and they get this big van and they drive out into the middle of the Mojave Desert, because these grays never appear at any place except out in the desert or at the cheap parks, okay?
Or in Whitley Strieber's bedroom. But
that's right. And then what they do is they get these loudspeakers that play these four notes from Steven Spielberg's movie. I mean, you could make a hilarious film about people doing just what it is that you're talking about. But I guess, you know, it's the same for people who believe in God. You know, they say God is created, a man is created in God's image. And no, the truth is God is created in man's image. Man is not created in God's image. I mean, because for thousands and thousands of years, there was a God for water and a God for fire and a God for the seeds, and there was a God for everything, because people then didn't know how things worked. And then as they began to realize that things worked in a natural way, then along comes Moses and say, hey, forget all these other gods. We just need one for stuff we don't know already. So anyway, but I didn't.
Well, and strangely enough, he acts like a kind of like a petulant child. At least the Yahweh version does, not the Jehovah. But yeah. it's this is why, like, when I was making my attempt at the film, I was basically made a sizzle reel for it by shooting. I actually would be very earnest in my desire to explore how people earnestly believe in what they believe. I'm not here to judge. I'm fascinated that people believe what they believe. And really, if you think about it, believing that aliens have some religious significance in the creation of mankind makes just as much sense, if not more, because at least there's some scientific underpinning to the idea that maybe aliens are coming here and interfering with our DNA, and we're basically a genetic experiment.
What is so true about what you just said, the two most interesting things to investigate in the world that could probably never be explained are the origins of the universe and how people get to believe the stuff they believe.
Yes, right. Right. But, you know, look, a lot of this stuff is coping strategies. One of the things that is really interesting about what David was doing in his investigations is he was not doing it as a coping strategy. He was doing it as an earnest investigator. And I think that's what makes what he was doing in his film interesting. Now, what makes what you did in your film interesting is that with the Garrison tapes, I still say it is the single greatest documentary on the mechanics, explaining the mechanics of the assassination, because it explained Garrison's investigation, and Garrison is the guy who actually did the most to establish the facts, much like David did in his book, the 411 book. So now you have the second film, which is the follow-up, and it's available, John. Tell people how they can get it, because we only have like 40 seconds left.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Oh, thank you. Well, people can get it. All they have to do is they go to Amazon, and they just search the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available for only $1.99, and you can buy it for $4.99. I've had a number of people from Europe contact me via email and Facebook saying that they cannot get it because their credit card is not based in America. And somebody in England said what they can do is they can buy an Amazon gift card in Europe or in Australia and use the gift card to access the film. And it's selling about 35 or 40 a day, which is quite remarkable because it's only been up for about a week. And right now I am negotiating with an outfit called Juice in Canada, which is the largest supplier to Netflix. And if Juice gets on board and we get this on Netflix, it could sell literally thousands upon thousands. And the first monies that we get, we are going to build a scholarship at Tulane University for needy law students in the name of Jim Garrison.
A worthwhile cause, a man who is long overdue his just due as a hero of the 20th century in American life and politics.
There will never, ever, ever be another Jim Garrison. And when we had James Corbett on last week, as you well know, James Corbett said, you know, that there are a lot of anomalies in 911, but we'll never have no investigation into that because there is no longer a Jim Garrison. Anyway, Joe, thank you very, very much. They can see you on the Acelli Report on Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Go to Amazon. Get the movie, folks. $1.99, right? Go get it, folks. And John, we'll talk in a couple weeks.
Okay, thanks so much, Joe. And folks, thank you so very much. My thanks to Doug and Don Newsom, who run this great network, Mike Kim, the producer, without whom I could not do this show. And as Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.